I'm so happy, excited, and full of joy that today I can welcome Mark Nepo as an expert and guest to the Conscious Evolution Summit.
Well, it's so wonderful to be here with you. Thank you.
It really means a lot for me to have you, and I want to also welcome our audience listening to the audio, watching the video. A warm welcome and a thank you that you take your time, that you are interested in your inner growth, in expanding, in diving into the unknown and finding out more about this very unique and exciting time we are living in. So I see it more as an adventure, and I'm very connected to the positive in it and to the possibilities which maybe may show up for us. So I'm really very kind of positive and see it as a big chance to move into something very fascinating. And Mark, maybe to start, maybe you can give a bit a background. I mean, we will really focus on your new book where you share about this coming together. But to give our audience a bit of background, through which experiences and challenges in life did you went and grow in order to kind of
share that. Yeah, sure. Thank you. So, I'm a poet and a philosopher and a teacher and a long-term cancer survivor. I'm 67, and in my 30s is when I had a very serious struggle with a rare form of lymphoma, in which I almost died. Thank God I'm here. And to go back to give a little context, I've always, even as a little boy, when I was alone, I never felt alone. I felt like everything larger than me was speaking to me. I didn't have any language for that, but now I know that life, the universe, God, whatever name you want to give to what's larger than us, was speaking to me through metaphor. That's the way that I understand the patterns. The wind through the trees was saying, listen, listen, look, this is like what? And so, as I grew, as I went to school, I mean, I started writing because in high school, the first woman I fell in love with dumped me and broke my heart, and which everyone goes through. And I didn't have, I wasn't a loner, but I had acquaintances in high school. I had close friends when I got to college. So at that time, I began writing as a way to help myself heal. And, very early, which is still a very, very fundamental healing principle, is expressing the truth of our experience and feelings connects us to everything. And so, as I started to heal, I realized I wasn't just having a conversation with myself. I had begun a conversation with the universe. And writing was the trail of that conversation and inquiry and learning. So as we move forward, and especially about this book, amazingly, is my 20th book. I never imagined that. I just was imagined, just being here. But what happened is in my, mid-30s, through my cancer journey, I was raised Jewish. I'm Jewish by heritage. But I'm a student of all paths. And that has affected all my work, because during that journey of almost dying 30 years ago, I was blessed to have the help and love and support from people from all traditions. And I say traditions widely, even people who believed in science, even atheists, all kinds of people kindly helped. So when I woke up still here, I was not and am still not wise enough to know what worked and what didn't. And so I feel that I was invited, challenged, compelled to believe in everything. And all my work, all my books, all my teaching since then have been devoted to trying to reveal what I feel is the common center of all paths, discern the unique gifts of each, and because of my journey as a cancer survivor, to take that extra step through my work and through my teaching to try to help myself and others. Where do we and how do we apply that in our daily lives? What is our daily spiritual practice? So, you know, I think this book, More Together Than Alone, Discovering the Power and Spirit of Community, started about 14, 15 years ago, and I became interested in moments of community, whether they were a moment like this between you and me, or a long moment like 400, 500, 600 years on the Iberian Peninsula, where, you know, Muslims and Jews and Christians not only lived together, but thrived together and were better for having lived together and listened to each other and learned from each other. So I became interested in the lineage of moments when we worked well together and the lessons from them, because this lineage of care and interdependence is a great resource, and it's quieter. So it bears lifting up and looking at. And I would say now, when I look back, I think my journey through cancer was my first experience of raw and unbreakable community before I even knew about wanting to do this. And that was that, you know, I was thrust in, and I think anyone who's experienced a life-threatening situation will know this, I was thrust into waiting rooms and treatment rooms. And all of a sudden, there was a community, a tribe of people going through a similar thing. I was closer to those people than anyone else on earth. I don't even know their last names or what they did for a living, because all of a sudden, there you are, and you're afraid and you say, hi, hi, yeah, my name, how you doing? Oh, not so good, I'm afraid, me too. And so all the things we think about, what are the requisites to get to know each other, just drop away. And all it takes is the courage to be authentic and honest. And through that strength, because it is a strength, we discover our kinship. So that's a little bit of how I've come to this inquiry. And I looked across, and that's why it took so long, because of research. And I researched not as an academic, as a poet, as a cancer survivor, as someone trying to learn that, you know, there are other generations, the human tribe has done this before. What can we learn? And so it's not definitive by any means, because it's impossible to be definitive. It's just what I could gather, what drew me, what compelled me, what I needed to learn from. And it was just a remarkable journey.
Mm-hmm. And in a way, Mark, what often stood out for me when I hear stories about really this togetherness, it often comes out of a challenge, of a disaster, of something really difficult where these miracles happen, where we come together and support each other. So,
well, yes,
similar, you know, experience in your research, that kind of that difficulty or challenge really kind of seems to draw up something in us which maybe isn't so much on the surface usually.
Well, and I think that, you know, that there are two major ways that human beings grow. One is by willfully shedding what's in the way or what no longer works, even though it maybe worked before, because we're dynamic, we keep growing. You know, after all, when a butterfly leaves its cocoon, the cocoon wasn't false, it served its purpose. And so, you know, the self that we are in currently may be a cocoon for our own evolution. And so when we evolve from it, it doesn't mean that, oh, that must have been false. It means it served its purpose and we grew. But we, being human, we resist shedding. And so the other major way that we grow is by being broken open. And, you know, there's an old Roman saying, you know, the fates lead those who are willing. Those who are not, they drag. So I think that there is this amazing, I think that whatever created this mysterious harmony that we live in made life just difficult enough that we need each other to ensure the journey of love. And when we dare to, when we are broken open or we willfully shed, and all the traditions speak about this in different ways, but they all say, we discover then that, oh, we at heart, we're the same. At heart, we're connected. And then everything changes. You know, in the Native American tradition, the worldview of the Native American tradition has this beautiful principle called all my relations. Mm-hmm. And we think about, you know, family as relations, and the Native Americans extend family to all of existence. Yes, the moon is my relation. The grass is my relation. So much so that I learned that in the Blackfoot tribe, you know, we say when we first greet each other, oh, hi, how are you? Well, no, they say, Sa ni da bi wa, which means, how are the connections? Forget how you and I are. If the connections are okay, we're okay. And if the connections are not, we better tend to them and then we'll see how we are.
Oh, I resonate a lot with that. That's really Yeah. So I was once in a lecture of a physicist. He basically died a few years ago. He was very famous, a German physicist. And he also said that in a way, we should call each other, it's a bit difficult to translate it into English, but kind of constant translated relating things. Just relating. That's what we are and how we live here, constantly relating.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, and then we can talk a little bit about the time we're living in, but let me... before that, you know, there's always been throughout history an unsolvable perennial argument. There are those who want to say that human beings, you know, need controls and restraints, that basically, you know, we're not really good, we're confused, we're worse than animals, and we need all of the constraints and laws and things to prevent us from hurting each other. And there's the other side, which obviously I, from my work, I'm a part of. I know from your work, you are too, which says, no, human beings innately are good and kind. And it's the pain and circumstance and suffering of the world that blocks us from that goodness from time to time. And it's love and connection and relationship that renews our goodness. And so in the Chinese tradition, there's a philosopher, Mencius, who was about 200 years after Confucius. And he had a beautiful way of talking about this. And he used the metaphor of water. He said, water allowed its true nature will always flow downhill and join other water. It can be manipulated to go sideways, be held behind a dam, go up, go through pipes, have force, you know, but allowed its own true nature, it will always flow downhill and join other water. And he said, so too people, we are like this. We allowed our true nature. We will always flow and join each other and help each other. But we can be manipulated, or we can manipulate ourselves to go against our true nature. But thankfully, we can recover.
Yeah. Yeah, lovely. And what would you say, what supports us? I mean, I guess there are many, many possibilities, but maybe what stood out for you in your life and maybe in your research, what inner attitude or what circumstances, how can we help each other to really kind of take away what hinders us in really expressing that and sharing that?
Well, I think that, and again, the traditions speak about this in different ways, but basically for me, there are some basic ways of being and approaching life. And the one comes down to being present. What does that mean? We have all these meditation traditions. We have all kinds of things. What it means to me is leaning into life and holding nothing back. That returns us to the freshness of the miracle that this doesn't have to be this way. The miracle that we're here at all. How rare it is to be alive. How rare it is. And that is a lens, a heart lens, that pain, worry, fear, circumstance gives us static and distracts us. And part, so much of, I think, of the spiritual practice, our personal spiritual practice, is a practice of return. So I say lean in, because all the difficult things in life push us away. And so the most important time to lean in is when we're pushed away. The most important time to open is when fear closes us. The most important time to listen is when I don't feel I can listen anymore. So this takes a quiet courage to lean in. And when we, and that's why there's so much talk, and rightfully so, of being in the moment. Well, being in the moment is not an, you know, a cartoon of that today in modern times is, oh, that means I have no responsibility and I can just party. And joy comes from being in the moment. But more importantly, when we can be in the moment, we restore our connection to everything that is not us. And in that oneness, it gives us fresh eyes, a fresh mind, a fresh heart. And now we see, feel, and hear differently and think differently. And then we make different decisions. Mm-hmm. And so that's why to start with being present and leaning in and holding nothing back is so important. I think two other relational timeless tools are holding and listening. They have never failed. And any time in my life that I have been held or listened to, or when I have been able to hold or listen, I am restored to authenticity and kinship. So, again, the difficult things of life isolate us. So let me connect this to a way of a parable in here in the new book, The Two Tribes, and talk about, because this is very much in our time. You know, in the time we're in globally, it feels like there's a resurgence of isolation, of fear, of pushing difference away. And as I've tried to be with this, and I don't have any answers, but as I've tried to be with this as a citizen of the world, as a descendant of the Jewish culture who, you know, had people in my grandparents' generation die in the Holocaust, when would I ever think that I would see Nazis walking in the streets of America? What am I to do with that? I don't have any answer, but I know in support of every ancestor and anonymous ancestor who came before me, every day I wake up now and say, How am I called to be more visible? How am I called to, and every day I'm not sure what that is. So as I've thought about this more and more globally, it seems that in history and in the research that I've done through all these years, like waves in the ocean, there are times when we push each other away, and then there are other times when we come together. And so as I traced this back and thought about it, I thought about, imagine in cave times, and I imagine the first two people to realize they were not alone. Imagine one cave person, he or she, came to the mouth of a cave and saw another in there, and they saw each other. They said, well, what are you doing here? And the one in the cave, I imagine that person looked at their different other and said, you're different, go away. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the beginning of the go away tribe, based on fear. And throughout history, whenever we, and the stories that I've researched bear this out, throughout history, when we've been so afraid, then we say, oh, I can't trust you'll go away, so I'm going to put you where I can see you and watch you. So I'll put you in a ghetto, in a camp, in a refugee center. Mm-hmm. I'll make you live over there on that side of town. And in the malignant, terrible, worst obsession with fear, we have had periods of genocide where the people in the go-away tribe have said, I can't trust you'll be where I put you. I need to make you go away. Mm-hmm. But if we go back to that mouth of the cave, the other, seeing someone different, said, oh, you're different. Come teach me. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the beginning of the come teach me tribe. Oh, thank God you're not like me. Teach me what I don't know. Together, we are more than alone. Mm-hmm. And in the greatest periods of that sensibility, we have had the greatest periods of enlightenment throughout history. You know, in one amazing, in second century BC, in what was Persia, there was an empire known as the Gandhara Empire. And it was a highly educated empire and widely open and open-minded and open-hearted. So there was it was also multicultural. So this empire, at its height, it had one of the first universities in the world, Taxila University. It would house like 10,000 students. And the students would live in what we would call dormitories. They lived in residences with their teacher, 500 to a teacher.
Wow.
And so this is what I mean about come teach me. You're different. Come teach me. We'll know we are more together than alone. That model, that university in the second century BC, education was free. Mm-hmm. The wealthy in the community helped pay for everyone. And, using knowledge for your own self-interest was thought sacrilegious. Just remarkable. I mean, that's just one example. But to come back to our two tribes, and this is very important, the real heart of this parable, we belong to both tribes. Mm. On any given day, we can switch tribes. Mm-hmm. I'm saying this to you now, and I'm devoted to the Come Teach Me tribe. And I could have something happen that is so painful or it's so fearful that tomorrow I will wake up part of the Go Away tribe, and I'll need you to remind me because we're more together than alone. Mm-hmm. You know, there's in the back of the book, I also have a chapter that has eight worldviews and a practice for each. And there's one in there that it comes to mind now because of what we're talking about. In the Lebanese tradition, there's a greeting, Ye Ayuni. Like when you see someone comes in the door, oh, Ye Ayuni. And it literally means, oh, my eyes, you're here. Now we can see.
Oh, I like that.
Oh, my eyes, you're here. Now we can see. Now, because no one view is enough. No one view is enough. And so, you know, in the Chinese tradition, mythology tradition, there's a mythical bird called the Qian. It has one eye and one wing, and its entire destiny is to find another Qian, so together they can fly and see.
Beautiful. So it's really, I mean, in the whole conversation, there's really, I so much resonate with that. In a way, it's already really there as a fundament, and it resonates so much. I know that it's true, and I know that we could really express it more. And what I really also like a lot, that you also bring in this, that it's, yes, we can be in certain circumstances where we belong to the other tribe, but let's remember each other. I really like that, because that also brings this, you know, not judging if you kind of lose the track, but let's help us together to find back, and having this compassion towards ourselves and towards others.
Well, and there's, you know, at the heart, there's a story. It's too long, but I'll give you the essence of it. That's a story in the life of Buddha that has a profound teaching about just what you were saying. And it's Buddha and Agilamala. So Agilamala was a serial killer at the time. And Buddha, he was captured, and he was waiting to be hung. And Buddha was walking through the town, and he was known as a teacher. So he went to those who were holding him and said, I'd like to meet with this man. And the story is that Buddha was alone with Agilamala, and they faced each other in silence for a long time. And finally, Buddha looked at Agilamala and said, I have stopped. You have not stopped. That's all he said. And then they were silent for a much longer time. And then Agilamala said, I'm ready to die for what I've done. And then Buddha looked at him and said, there's plenty of time to die. Are you willing to reclaim your humanity for what you've done? And then Buddha left. And it is said that from the time that Buddha and Agilamala talked to the time that Agilamala was hung were the only authentic moments in his life. And the two important things there that are so relevant to us, I think, today is, first, this riddle, this spiritual riddle. And it helps to look now, as we look at this, it's, you know, what had Buddha stopped and that Agilamala didn't stop? And it's not so much in that story, but if we look, as many stories represent, we have that deeper, you know, come teach me light in us. And we have the fear-based murderer in us. These are parts of ourselves that if we feed either part, you know, wonderful things or terrible things can happen. So Buddha, there's always that voice in us. This is a conversation for each of us to have, to say, what in us is, we can murder our own energy, murder our clarity, we can murder our sense of oneness, we can murder the fullness of our heart. So our deeper soul, which is the Buddha light, and whatever you want to call it, Dharma, the Buddha nature, we all have that. And we all have these conversations that when we are doing things that are disheartening to ourselves and others, our soul's saying, have you stopped? What is it you need to stop? You know what you need to stop. Do you need to stop replaying that you're unworthy? Do you need to stop playing that you're always afraid? Do you need to stop? What is it you need to stop in order to let me back in. So this is a very powerful question for all of us to regularly ask when we feel ourselves tightening, distancing, feeling fearful and in pain. And the second one is very powerful too, and that is, Buddha says, no, there's time enough to die. Are you willing to do what it takes to reclaim your humanity? And this is, you know, thousands of years ago, but this is at the heart of restorative justice. What do we do to become human again? Because the things that make us hurt each other, we get numb to our voice and our gift and our humanity, and we need to do the work to reclaim it. And then, you know, we can see this in large ways, but in very small ways every day, we do, we do this. I'm exhausted and I'm not thinking and I'm impatient with those around me, and it causes me to inadvertently hurt those I love. So now what do I have to do? Well, the first thing is I have to own the truth of my actions. And then, and we all know this is, you know, the 12-step program in Alcoholics Anonymous, which those steps are a wonderful relational healing steps that can be appropriated whether people are addicted or not. So we own our actions, the truth of our actions, and we make amends. We make amends. Sometimes I think that the only difference between those who are wise and those who are not is that those who are wise own their mistakes.
Yeah, beautiful. And in a way, Mark, what also interests me, how was your research? Did you also speak to people which shared your stories, or was it more researching in history, or is it both?
Yes, it was both. So being a poet and a teacher, it was very intuitive heart research. I was doing research, in search, live search, and was looking with my heart as a kind of Geiger counter, looking for places where, oh, there's something there. What is it? And then, you know, at one point there was so much I had researched, and I, you know, had 150 pages of notes of places to research further. Mm-hmm. And I then wound up enlisting. I had a research assistant that I hired, and it was I had, the first thing we had to do was to have conversations so she could understand what I was looking for, because not just look for what I thought was, but to use her own humanity to intuitively find. And then she came back a year and a half later with almost 400 pages of notes for me. Yeah.
Wow.
And so,
yeah. No, go on.
No, so, you know, so one of the stories about that is so powerful comes from in West Africa, in what is now Angola. Now, we all know that European nations colonized so many of third world countries, and especially through Africa and India. There were two or three small Western African countries, and they, Ghana, Angola, I can't remember the third one right now, but during the 1400s, Portugal colonized them and became oppressors. And the story is that what is now Angola, a ship of Portuguese sailors landed, as they would do, and a tribe of warriors, native warriors, captured them, and they didn't hurt them. They tied them up. They brought them back to their tribe in the interior, stood them there tied up, and through a translator, made them listen to everyone of their people tell the stories of what it was like to live under their rule, how it hurt them, what it did to them. And then without hurting them, they took those sailors back to their ship, untied them, and let them go. Mm-hmm. And they did this through the course of years, 3, 4, 5 times. And in about 100 or 80 years later, there was a rebellion which led to ending Portuguese rule in what is now Angola, started by those sailors. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Power, not a vengeance, mm-hmm. but the strength of accountability and truth. Mm-hmm. They merely had them listen to the truth mm-hmm. of their actions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, when I hear that, I really can sense the intimacy in this act, the intimacy, what is in sharing like that. I mean, there is almost no other way than that it touches deeply.
And so much of our trouble, I think, and our pain comes from running. When we run from the truth of our experience, we don't calm it, we intensify it. Mm-hmm. And then the need to face it doesn't go away. Mm-hmm. And then we play it out on others. Mm-hmm. And then we play it out on others. Mm-hmm. And so if we want to reduce violence in the world, the first thing we can do is to face ourselves, to accept the truth of our own pain and our own experience so that we don't perpetrate it unconsciously on others. Mm-hmm. There's a, you know, and this leads to the intrinsic connection between inner work and service. Mm-hmm. And to support that, the great Hindu sage Ramana Maharshi, there's a quote of his, and he said, to try to save the world before liberating yourself is like carpeting the earth rather than wearing sandals.
There is a picture.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, beautiful. It's I really love it how you really bring it together, this connection between the inner work and the ability to be really of service out there. For me it's really a very crucial fact to look at.
In Dante's Divine Comedy, there is a ring in purgatory for people who do good poorly. They're not in hell because they're doing good, but they're not in paradise because they're doing good poorly. And I think often, you know, we all are capable of it, but again, it's about the work of self-awareness, is to recognize that so we can shift it. You know, I think one of the understandable ways that we do good poorly is when we're not facing the truth of our lives. And it's a very natural thing, even meaning well. I've done it at times. We often love in the way that we would like to be loved. Mm. We go to a situation and bring how we would like to be helped in it, and seldom ask what's really needed. Mm. The first time I really learned this was in a former marriage. my in-laws were farmers, excuse me. And my father, former father-in-law and he was probably in his 70s at this time. He lived to be 85. But his sister was in the hospital, and she had cancer, and she was dying. And this was a man who, a good man, but very quiet. He, you know, I don't know that he said as many words as we've said to each other in this interview in 5 years. So he's very taciturn, very quiet, but a very good man. And all of a sudden, when she was in the hospital, he was incredibly vocal with an urgency. And he wanted us to set up a schedule so that she would never, around the clock, she wouldn't be left alone. He didn't want her left alone. And that's when I understood for the first time, he was telling us what he wanted when it was his turn, which was very touching. But the truth was, no one ever asked his sister what she wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So it's understandable. And the more we don't face our truth, the more we do this, giving what we think is needed or wanted, even imposing it on others. And when we start imposing it, you know, we didn't know what she wanted, but what if she wanted, needed the opposite? Then even out of love, his imposition of that company was a kind of unconscious violence to her.
Mm. Yeah.
No question, he loved her. It all came out of love.
Mm.
So ever since then, I've been very aware that, you know, my first reaction may be something, I want to give something. But then I really work hard to say, have I asked what is needed?
Mm-hmm.
Have I asked what is needed? You know, I had a dear friend who helped me through my cancer journey. He's now gone. And about 6 or 7 years after I was well, he got sick. So I wanted to be there for him, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the way that I went through it was very open, and I needed to talk and be with people. And he was right there. So I assumed that this would be how I could be there for him the way he was for me. He didn't want any of it. He was completely the opposite. He didn't want to talk about it. He didn't. And so I helped him by following his lead, by giving him what he wanted. But what it told me was that he loved me so much that wasn't natural for him to be with me the way I needed.
Mm-hmm.
It was even so that reinforced even more that we really need to ask what is needed. And it's led to a small poem of mine that goes like this: the mystery is that whoever shows up when we dare to give has exactly what we need hidden in their trouble.
Mm. Mm. Lovely. Mm. Mm. Beautiful.
Thank you.
Mm. So what I get really out of this conversation, Mark, is really a lot of mobility is kind of needed to be able to shift perspectives, to draw the attention from us also onto others, to be really in this relationship, in asking, in checking in. And so I really get a lot of mobility when I listen to you, because I often experience what you are sharing, and I sense that, and it feels really enriching if we could really kind of welcome that and practice that more.
Yeah, I think that, you know, this is a very important distinct, like one of the things that prevent us from flowing to each other, as Mencius said, in kindness and being in fear. And one of them is our self-centeredness.
Mm-hmm.
And there, I quote in the book, there's a developmental psychologist at Harvard, Robert Keegan, Mm-hmm. And he has this amazing definition. It's very helpful. He talks about centrism, whether it's egocentrism or national centrism, you know, or ethnocentrism, anything where we're the center. He defines that, he says, it's when we mistake what is familiar as true.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, we see what is unfamiliar as false.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're back to the go away tribe. You're different, go away. And that is a very, that's an emotional, toxic way of being.
Mm.
So we all can fall into it. But again, the thing is that we need as many views as possible. And this is where we're more together. You know, another tradition, we go back to the Native American tradition, and I learned that elder councils, which still meet today, they have always met in circle. Not for equity, because there's no head to the circle. They've always met in circle so that everyone has a direct view of the center.
Mm-hmm.
And so what can we learn from that? Well, the implication, the assumption under it, beautiful assumption, is we need everybody's view to understand the center,
mm-hmm.
to access the center. No one view will do it. So that says, we gather meaning, we don't choose it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And as I get older, you know, honestly, I'm not interested in argument, debate, persuasion. They all seem like a waste of time to me.
Mm-hmm.
I need to know your truth and mix it with mine and everyone else I can meet.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're more together than alone. We see more together than singly. We feel more together than singly. And so this leads us to one of the greatest teachers of all time, and that is paradox.
Mm-hmm.
Because paradox, we can say, is any moment where more than one thing is true at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And the mind wants to try to solve paradox, but the heart, when I can let your view and my view and someone else's view and something that's opposite in, the heart holds it until it releases a deeper logic of the spirit.
Mm-hmm. So true. And I experienced really, I would say, the last 10 years in my journey, in my growth, is a constantly process of expanding, making on so many levels myself bigger to be able to really hold those differences and to embrace them. So I feel it energetically pulling on me. I feel it in dreams. I feel it in life. So this constantly growing. And yeah, that those paradoxes can live inside a form in a way.
Yes.
Yeah, beautiful. I mean, do you have one or two stories you like a lot in this book you would like to share, or maybe stories that didn't make the way into the book?
Yes.
Sharing them in the interview. So
yeah, sure. So one story that I think is very, very powerful, it's a story of, it's a creation story from Canada, the First Nations people in Canada. And up there, I discovered it because in Vancouver, and this is one of the stories where I was out finding it, in the museum, there's a Native American museum, the largest in North America. There's an entire small building that has one sculpture in it, an enormous wooden sculpture in yellow cedar. Took Bill Reed, the artist, First Nations artist, 10 years to carve it. And it's a sculpture of a shell, like a clam shell, that's just opening, and human beings are starting to come out of it. And some are like curious, and some are like pulling back, and on top is a raven. And so as I learned about this, raven is the trickster spirit in that culture, and which means that Raven supports and challenges growth. It affirms growth, but it challenges growth. So let me pause for a second, because all attendant spirits throughout history have done that, both. We in the West, in the Renaissance and Elizabethan times, we separate the word daemonian means attending spirit, which can challenge us or affirm us. We separated that into angel and demon. So that's just a pause there. But trickster, the raven is the trickster spirit, and the creation story is that Raven pulls the shell open and is coaxing human beings to come into the world for the first time. And there are some that are, wow, what's this? And there are others, I don't know if I want to go out there. And the trickster part of Raven says, come, come, you must come out. And of course, once they're out, they can't go back. And they have to help each other live here and find the beauty and truth and endure the suffering and the difficult things. And so this is a powerful parable about what faces all of us, because every person ever to live faces the challenge of coming out of their shell. And community is helping each other, like Raven, to come out of our shell, and once out, helping each other live here. So this is a parable that's worth asking personally and community-wise. What is the shell that you are struggling to emerge from right now? And asking that personally and as a community. In our community, what is the shell we're trying to come out of right now? What can we do to help our fellow tribe members emerge? And once they're out, what can we do with them? You know, this, as a lifelong teacher, early on, I was very moved in the first 10 years of my teaching. I taught at a university for many years. Now I teach by going around with my books and doing workshops and conferences and things. But when I was teaching, it became clear to me at one point the responsibility that if you open someone's heart or mind, a teacher has a responsibility to accompany those beings. You just can't do that and walk away. You know, so many people in the rational world want to say, well, my job is just to give knowledge. Well, if you have a glass of water and you put a drop of iodine in it, it colors the entire glass, not just the top inch. You put a question or a truth or a heart truth, it colors the entire being of the student that is before you. And if someone does that, then I feel we have an ethical responsibility to stay with them until we know that they're okay.
Yeah, and often this can kind of be really a years-long journey in a way to integrate something you deeply realized into all your levels, into all the different contexts in life. So it is, I'm really kind of not so much a fan of this instant things, which are kind of propagated, because my experience is the good stuff really takes a while.
So let me share. I want to share one other story. Well, it's kind of one story and one comes out, a small one comes out of it, but from the book. And this comes from the Holocaust. And actually, it was also from a personal, I didn't just read it in a book, but a dear friend and mentor of mine, Joel Elkies, he died a few years ago at 102. he was a child of the Holocaust. And this is the story of his father, who was the chosen elder of the Kovno ghetto in Lithuania. And he was commanded to be the one who would interface with the Nazis who were holding them in the ghetto. And eventually they were all moved to Auschwitz. And once that was known, and he had kept this ghetto alive, a life in there, there was a symphony, an underground symphony, an underground school. So once he knew that they tried to free as many people as they could, and they would throw young children in potato sacks over the fence. Mm-hmm. And this is a side story, one of those children was picked up, brought across borders, finally landed in Israel, and grew up to be Aaron Barak, who became one of the Supreme Court justices in the Supreme Court of Israel.
Yeah.
Also, while they were doing that, Joel's father, Elkanan Elkies, he asked the Underground Symphony to prepare a final concert before they were all trained to Auschwitz, and they played Beethoven's Ode to Joy.
Mm.
And the more that I have meditated or reflected on that, knowing that there was no way out, they chose to open the eternal moment and not distract themselves from what was before them, but to root themselves beneath what was coming in the joy of life. Incredibly courageous. The final part of this story, in how we're more together than alone, is that Joel's mother, Elkanan's wife, Miriam Elkies, she survived Auschwitz and spent her final days in Israel. And toward the end of her life, and like many Holocaust survivors, she never really talked about it. And one day, toward the end of her life, she just started talking to Joel as if they had talked about it forever, like she was picking up a conversation. And she said, "There were two things that enabled me to survive Auschwitz." She said, "Every day I carried a broken crust of bread on me in case I ran into someone more in need than me."
Mm-hmm.
And she had a broken piece of comb, and she said every night she would, with this broken piece of comb, she would comb her hair, not to look pretty, not for vanity, but to affirm her person.
Mm-hmm.
These are modern myths. And what Joel's mother, Miriam, offered, this is a modern myth that I offer you and myself and everyone who's listening. We can help move from the go away tribe to the come teach me tribe by simply asking every day, what are you carrying today? What small thing are you carrying in case you run into someone during the day that's more in need than you? And what one gesture are you doing every day to affirm your person?
Mm-hmm. Very beautiful. I will carry that.
Oh, thank you.
Well, I'm really very touched from what you shared, I really hope that we kind of connect deeply in these roots. How you said it so beautifully, underneath. You said underneath.
Yes, underneath. We are always more than what is done to us.
Yeah. 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 Beautiful. You shared a lot, and you gave also what I really liked. You gave really some suggestions which are easy to take away out of this conversation and to really practice it and bring it into our lives. And I just want to give you, before we come to a closure, the opportunity, if there is anything left when you think about this, how can we really consciously make steps into our growth, into our next chapter, into really our evolution as humans, where we get aware of all our dimension. I guess it's so important to be aware of the physical, of the energy, of the seen, of the unseen. And when you hear that, what would you like to give people to kind of make the best out of this special time?
Well, I think that, you know, for me, I would say that I would offer an invite to start, for everyone to start where you are. One of the insidious assumptions that begins to eat at all of us and remove us from the wholeness and depth and fundamental spirit we're born with is the assumption that life is always over there. Life is always, if I could just go over there, if I could get that relationship or that job or be like that person. And if anything, you know, especially my journey of almost dying has taught me is that there is no there. There's only here. And in order to that, and that comes back to being present. So to start where we are, and, you know, Mother Teresa said, courage is doing small things with love. So I would encourage and invite everyone, if moved, to truly be where you are, to open, you know, the flowers, the iris and the peonies and the orchids, you know, they literally open inside out. Their beauty comes from opening inside out. And rather than going from here to there, we need, by being authentic and vulnerable and truthful and courageous, we really need to open inside out. And then the entirety of humanity will become its own garden.
Lovely. Yeah, and also as the flowers, they don't really mind if someone watches them, sees them, and finds them beautiful. They just spread their beauty no matter what. Lovely. Thank you so much, Mark. It was so beautiful to listen to your experiences and your stories, and I feel really it's moving. It will move after the interview because it touched so much in me where I resonate with.
Oh, I'm so glad. I'm so glad. And thank you for the work you're doing. And I'm so glad to be a part of it.
Thank you so much. And thank you for everyone taking this time, tuning in to this conversation between Mark and myself. And I hope you also got touched and you also resonate with what you heard, and maybe you are curious to apply it just where you are in your life, in every situation you are in. And really also what I also want to encourage, to be open, to be intimate with whatever experience you experience, and be curious to find out how it is now, because it can be so different than it was the other time, and that's really aliveness. So thank you so much, and bye-bye.